celebrating 30 years of broadcast excellence. The Evening Rush on 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town.
504, Sheriff Clark in studio. WMCS, the talk of the town, the Evening Rush. And we're going to switch gears a little bit here and move into a different issue, an issue that confronts this community. Much like the last issue with education, this one is it's a little closer to home for me. It's on the issue of violence. Violence in this community, the levels, as far as I'm concerned, are still too high, even though there have been improvements. But I can't think of anything more static than a statistical interpretation of how safe a city is. I think you have to go down into some of these neighborhoods with people who live with it every day and get their assessment, not just a statistician. Real lives, real people, people who are intimidated, people who can't let their children go out and play in front of their own homes, seniors, prisoners in their own homes. And I'm joined in studio today by a woman who has, for quite some time now, been committed to stemming this violence, making a difference, Jerry Bonavina. She's no stranger to the show. She's worked on gun violence prevention since 1994 with an organization called WAVE, and she's become one of the leading voices of gun violence prevention. And although she maintains an interest in all areas of gun violence prevention, much of her work recently has centered on the structure and function of the unregulated secondary gun market. Jerry, thanks for joining us.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for having me here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about WAVE and some of your efforts?
Well, WAVE is a statewide grassroots organization, and we work exclusively on gun violence through education and advocacy. All of our work starts with the premise that gun violence is preventable. I know that sounds like a very basic statement, and for some people it sounds like a hope and a dream, but we know by looking at the evidence, by looking at research, and by looking at the experience of other states and other countries that we could be preventing gun violence much more effectively than we currently are here in the state of Wisconsin.
All right. And, you know, we talk about the secondary gun market and its effect that you and your organization believes it's having on gun-related violence in the Milwaukee area. And for our listeners, if you want to get in on this, 799-1290. You're listening to 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town. I don't know. I will take issue with this focus on the gun. The gun is an instrumentality used. I think it's more an issue of culture, of behavior. I think that there have been efforts made in the past to, you know, close loopholes to, you know, stricter gun control is really what we're talking about. I'm not an advocate of that. I believe that focusing on the gun is, again, is the technical fix. I think we need to talk more about the behavior exhibited by people who would take a firearm and use it to settle a dispute, would take a firearm and by force take somebody's property. The availability of guns is that thing that I think makes it not achievable in terms of getting all the guns off the street per se. My figures from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearm, and I was trained in firearms trafficking when I was with the Milwaukee Police Department, toured the trafficking facility in Virginia, and by their estimates, there are about 300 million guns in circulation in the United States today, and that's an estimate. That's enough to arm every man, woman, and child. That's why I say getting all these guns off the street is not achievable. However, there are some things that you and your organization believe could make a difference, but right up front, I'll challenge you on some of the things that have been tried in the past, the 48-hour waiting period, for instance. I don't have any data to support this, but it didn't seem to stem the violence. What's your take on the secondary market?
Oh boy, you've raised a whole bunch of issues here. So let me just start with probably the most basic, and that is whether we should be looking at the guns at all as having a role in this. And I would argue that there are enough characteristics about gun violence, gun violence, to make it worth looking at this as a separate problem. We know, for example, that if we compare our rates of violent crime with any other of the industrialized countries, we are very similar when it comes to rape rates or aggravated assault rates. It's what makes our country unique is the lethality of our violence, and that's completely attributable to our unique level of gun violence. So I think that this is a problem that we can separate out to some degree. I mean, we still need to look at the underlying causes, but we can also be looking at this as a separate problem. One of the things that we in particular are looking at right now is this secondary market, the unregulated market. And let me just describe very briefly what I'm talking about. Here in the state of Wisconsin, if you buy a gun from a licensed gun dealer, there are a number of things that you as the purchaser must do. You must show identification, you must have a criminal background check done, and the dealer needs to maintain a record of the sale. However, in the state of Wisconsin, it is also perfectly legal for an unlicensed seller or private individual to conduct firearm transactions. In those instances, there is no need to look at identification, and there is no background check done. And this is not some tiny little loophole. This is almost half of all gun sales in the state of Wisconsin. Having both a regulated and unregulated market legally operating means that we cannot possibly keep criminals away from guns. Right now, they have easy, unfettered access. And I like to compare it to airport security. If we had two lines of airport security, and in one line we said, you need to go through screening and your bag needs to be checked. Or if you prefer and you get to decide, you can just go ahead and get on the plane. There's no way that we would have any confidence that that type of security system would work, and it isn't working for gun sales either.
Well, I think, you know, like anything else, we're going to need multiple interventions. This is a very complex issue when we talk about violence, its causes. That's the instrumentality used. In the area of multiple interventions, because I believe focusing too much on the gun, even though it's an important variable, but focusing all of our efforts and too much on that is just going after the low-hanging fruit. One of the issues that I've raised centering around gun violence and those prohibited persons is the passive enforcement in terms of not the police. The police, I think, do an outstanding job of recovering guns, an outstanding job of arresting perpetrators, felons in possession of firearms, trafficking investigations, straw purchases. But where the breakdown occurs is either at the prosecution stage or at the court stage. And what happens too often is no matter what's done up front, you know, we could strengthen these loopholes and so on and so forth, but if a person is charged or arrested as a felon in possession or a straw purchaser, and it gets to the DA's office and they decide for some reason, well, we're not going to charge the straw purchaser, we'll charge the felon, but then it gets to court and they get a short period of incarceration, it's kind of diluted everything that we've tried to do. It's 5:12 p.m., 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town. Sheriff Clark in studio with Jerry Bonavina, and we're talking about anti-violence efforts that are going on. Focusing around gun control. And the thing that I will bring up as an example, I've been very out front and outspoken on the issue of drunk driving. And the reason I have, and I think this is a little known statistic, more people die in drunk driving related accidents across the United States than die in handgun deaths. That is true. Well, we can, I see you shaking your head, we can look that up later on and discuss it. But the point is this. With drunk driving, I don't blame the alcohol, which is, you know, the substance used. I don't blame the vehicle, which is the instrumentality, right? There's no crash without a vehicle. If someone's walking drunk driving, there's not going to be a crash. I don't target and I don't blame the automobile manufacturers for not doing more, doing their part, dealers for not checking to see. Has a person been arrested in the past for drunk driving, so on and so forth. And I'm not trying to shut down any taverns for serving people that probably don't need any more. I'm focusing on the driver who made a conscious decision to go out, consume more than they should, and then a conscious decision to get in an automobile and drive. And I see some parallels here where a felon knows darn well. They tell every felon at sentencing, you cannot possess a handgun, you can't own one, you can't be around one. But we're dealing with behavior because where there's a will, there's a way. Straw purchases are one way. The secondary market is a way. But I want to point to Washington, D.C., that had a total gun ban. And since that ban occurred in 1976, 8,400 people have been murdered in the District of Columbia, many killed by handguns. And this is an area that had a total ban. So you couldn't own, you couldn't possess, not even legally, not even background checks, so on and so forth. And yet Washington, D.C., after a total gun ban, became per capita the murder capital of the world. And that's why I question, you know, whether tightening up the loopholes. I'm not saying that shouldn't be done. I'm just saying I think we're a little naive to think that that's in and of itself is going to change behavior. Because what happened in Washington, D.C. is the firearms still flowed in from states surrounding states like Maryland and Virginia. And that's what I would see happening here. I mean, we talk about Badger guns. I'm telling you right now, you close down Badger guns tomorrow, and some other store is going to provide those guns. Where there's a will, there's a way. So what are you doing in your organization doing to deal with putting pressure on the district attorney in Milwaukee County to charge all these individuals and not let the straw purchaser go because, you know, well, you know, she didn't really know and she's an unwilling participant. And then at the judicial stage where basically these individuals are getting a slap on the wrist. 515, 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town. Sheriff Clark in with Jerry Bonavina. Jerry, go ahead.
Well, a couple of things here. One is I don't want to let the D.C. story go unchallenged because what happened is Washington, D.C. passed that law in 1975. It went into effect in 1976. If you look at the murder rates in that city, immediately following the passage of the law, they went down and then remained flat for quite a period of time. They didn't go up sharply until 15 years later, which tying, you know, an increase in murder rates to a law that was passed 15 years earlier wouldn't make a lot of sense. So you look at other factors, and what was driving the murder rate in D.C. along with the rest of the country was the crack epidemic at the end of the 1980s and the beginning of the 1990s. Did D.C. fare better than surrounding areas that didn't have those gun laws? Yes. Were they perfect? No. Have they been the murder capital of the country over all of these years? Absolutely not. They haven't been in the top 20 a number of these years. So I think we need to be careful when we retell that the D.C. experience and understand that although, yes, people were still killed because they aren't an island nation, they are surrounded by areas with easy access to guns. They probably did better. Lives were probably saved because of the law that they had. And also, I mean, we live in a democracy. The people of D.C. wanted that handgun ban. If they hadn't, you know, it wouldn't have existed to begin with. Is it right for everyone? Absolutely not. Was it right for them? Yes, at that time it was.
Do you favor a total, do you favor laws that, I mean, Chicago's dealing with it now. They have a very strict handgun law that is being challenged in the Supreme Court as we speak. That decision will probably come out spring, early summer. You know, there's a chance that that thing might be overturned, which will set a lot of these efforts back to, you know, get control of the transfer and sale and trafficking of handguns. But I want to go back to the behavior issue. What is your organization doing to put pressure on, for lack of a better way of putting it? You're on the district attorney's office. Are you looking at the prosecution rates? Are you looking at the sentences that are handed out? The people, this charge, felon in possession of a firearm, too often is just read into a criminal complaint or it's dropped in some other plea agreement. Those things, I think, are hurting in terms of changing behavior. It's 518 if you want to get in this conversation. 799-1290 WMCS, the talk of the town. Jerry, go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that needs to be looked at is that there are a number of laws that are misdemeanors. And for example, someone being charged with carrying concealed weapons on the street, whether it's their first offense or whether it's their fifth offense, it's still a misdemeanor. And so there isn't going to be a lot of motivation to put a lot of prosecutorial time and effort into getting someone for, you know, what a maximum sentence of 9 months and a fairly small fee. So, you know, I think one of the things that we need to do is look at whether the punishments actually match the crime and whether we're giving incentive to our judicial system to actually go after these cases. Because we know, as you've mentioned before, that these people who have weapons offenses are the ones who are going out and committing the crimes time and time and time again.
You know, this discussion, it seems to me to become circular in terms of getting tough on prohibited persons who would either illegally possess a firearm or use one to commit a crime. Chief Flynn was on the show last night and talked about going to Madison to put more teeth, as he put it, in some of the existing gun laws. But then we get to the issue of if we sentence more people, and we're talking about, you know, with the demographic of the perpetrator of a lot of this violence, sentencing, you know, black men to prison, and then we get into this discussion, all these black males in prison and disparate sentences, and, you know, when we talk about toughening laws, those are the issues that we're going to have to deal with. 5:20, I have to go to a break, but can you stay with us?
Yes, absolutely.
All right, I appreciate that. 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town, Sheriff Clark in the Evening Rush. We'll be right back.
This portion of the Evening Rush is being brought to you by Wendy's, and you know when it's real.
Celebrating 30 years of broadcast excellence. Now back to the Evening Rush with Earl Ingram on 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town.
Sheriff Clark in for Earl Ingram, the Duke of Earl, as I've renamed him. I'm joined in studio by Jerry Bonavina from the organization WAVE. It's an anti-violence effort focusing on gun crime. And let's go to the phones, 799-1290 if you want to get in. Michael, your question or comment on this issue, please.
How you doing, Sheriff Clark?
Wonderful.
I got a question about why the laws are so stringent in Milwaukee on a certain thing. Half the people that are in jail are in jail, well, in the house correction or in jail on nonviolent crimes. What is the law against carrying a weapon or having a weapon in your house when you have a right to bear arms? I mean, what's the difference between, say, a white guy carrying a gun and for, you know, not carrying it concealed, but carrying a gun for his own protection because he has a right to bear arms, and a black man carrying a gun unconcealed because he's got a right to bear arms?
Okay.
And that person being arrested or treated like, or the SWAT team breaks out because a black man's got a gun, but he's got a right to bear arms. And when a white person does it with a gun, I mean, there's no big deal. Well, why is that?
All right, and that's an excellent question. That's some of the confusion that exists in the state of Wisconsin. To directly answer your question, as it relates to carrying a weapon, and this thing was muddied a little bit by a recent Attorney General opinion, J.B. Van Hollen, who said that citizens could open carry. And what this comes down to is, can you lawfully possess a handgun? So if you're a convicted felon, the answer is no. If you have been judged mentally incompetent at any time in your life, the answer is no. If you're intoxicated, no, you can't possess a handgun while you're intoxicated. So the law in the state of Wisconsin is in conflict with the Constitution, and that being the Constitution says that a person has a right to defend themselves. And it doesn't specifically say they have the right to carry a firearm. And then there are some Second Amendment issues, but the right to protect yourself goes along with, you know, however reasonable means with which to carry that out. So if you're a legal person, if you're over 21 and you don't have a criminal history, haven't been judged mentally incompetent, or if you've been convicted of a domestic violence incident, and this is how complex this gets, well, then you can't possess a handgun either. But then it says you can go armed with a concealed and dangerous weapon. Now, this law says you can't conceal it. And then J.B. Van Hollen comes along and issues an opinion and says you can open carry it. And that's the confusion. The Wisconsin Supreme Court dealt with this issue recently and said to the legislature, your law on carrying a concealed weapon is in conflict with the state constitution, which says that people have the right to do this. So they told the state legislature to straighten it out. The state legislature ignored it and hasn't done anything, and that's part of the confusion. So I hope I answered your question as to who can do it. It doesn't matter, black, white, Hispanic. If you're prohibited, you can't. But if you're not, like I said, not a felon and those things, JB says you can openly carry it. The Constitution says you can conceal and carry it. That has to be hashed out in the courts. My position is I support law-abiding citizens' ability to be able to protect themselves, and then you have to allow them the instrumentality with which to do that. Doesn't necessarily have to be a handgun, but that's kind of the weapon of choice. People deserve that right, and you know, when the police cannot guarantee, and they can't, as good a job as we do, we can't guarantee that we're going to be able to be there when you need us at that time, at that moment, then I believe the government has an obligation to allow citizens to defend themselves and the instrumentality used reasonably. You know, you can't strap on a bazooka. I mean, that comes under a federal statute. But that's kind of where it's at right now. So as to people being locked up in jail, I'm going to go back to Jerry, and I want her to answer this question about this circular argument. If we toughen laws, which I'm not against, you know, felon in possession of a firearm, I'd like to see straw purchasers charged, but then we end up putting more people in prison, and we're asking them for stiff penalties, but then we deal with this issue, and Michael brought it up, you know, how do we reconcile this with you know, the amount of the black incarceration rate? Jerry, your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that we need to do is really prioritize, you know, for which offenses are we going to be very serious, for which offenses do we really want people separated from society, and I would make the argument that if we know that someone is at extraordinarily high risk for committing crimes with guns, particularly murder, and we do know how to identify those people, we know what the risk factors are, then maybe that rises to the top of the heap. Maybe those are the people who need to be separated from society.
I'm going to bring this back to the behavior issue. And you know, people who would, and it's an underclass value, people who would settle disputes with a firearm, people who would use a firearm to take property, to intimidate, so on and so forth. That's the tough thing, changing behavior. That's why I believe that incarceration works. I believe long periods of incarceration, it's not a magic pill, doesn't solve all of it, but it sends a different message. And right now, the prohibited persons are not getting the message that we're serious about this and trying to change the behavior. They know it's worth the risk, especially the straw purchasers. I think many of these individuals that are involved in a straw purchase, not the felon, but the person buying the gun for them, they're playing dumb like a fox. They know exactly what they're doing. They know they're buying this for somebody else. I wish the district attorney's office would take a stronger position on that and not look for ways to, you know, not want to charge them because they're, you know, an unwilling accomplice, so on and so forth. I just think we're sending the wrong message. Jerry, I'm going to give you the last word on this.
Well, you know, I think that punishment is an important part of this, but I don't think that we can ignore the prevention side of it. There are a number of things that we can do. We know they've worked effectively elsewhere. We can do them here, and we should be doing them here. Our community deserves that.
I agree, and I want to thank you for your efforts. Thank you for your commitment. You don't have to do this. You're obviously trying to make a difference. We need more people like you. So I, you know, and we will have an opportunity to work together. You and I, we're on the same community justice council. You know, we'll go back and forth on this gun control issue, and we'll see what happens down the road. But again, I want to thank you and your organization. It is 5:36. You're listening to 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town. The Evening Rush, Sheriff Clark in for the Duke of Earl, Earl Ingram. We'll be right back.
Just.
Celebrating 30 years of broadcast excellence, the Evening Rush on 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town.
Sheriff Clark in for the Duke of Earl, Earl Ingram, WMCS 1290, the talk of the town, the Evening Rush. And in this last segment, we're not going to get to Niger Ennis, who I had on tap, and he did call. I don't want to take a man of his stature and try to rush it into issue that I was going to talk to him about. These global warming policies is important in this community because of the impact that it's going to have on the poor, minorities, and the disadvantaged in terms of the cost of energy in this country. So I'm going to bring him back when I can spend the proper amount of time on that issue. I guess I wasn't a good clock manager on my first show here. I'll take the responsibility for that. It's all part of the learning curve and the learning process. But in these final minutes, I want to point to an issue that's reared its ugly head again in the Milwaukee area, the violence in Milwaukee public schools, specifically at Vincent High School. They had a big fight there the other night, and then some more trouble there yesterday. And I'm going to read from a report here. It says, police reported five students were either detained or arrested at Vincent High School on Tuesday, including one student who was fighting with a police officer and was shot with a taser during the arrest. The problems happened one day after the school became out of control and went into lockdown when fights erupted throughout the building. Parents of students who attended Vincent High School demanded change. Quote, I feel that the discipline is lackluster. I think that they should take a stronger stance on the students that are causing these problems, said one father, who only wanted to be identified as Mark. And I'm glad to see that parental involvement. That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. Milwaukee Public School spokeswoman Roseanne St. Albans said the district is taking steps to stop problems, including increasing the number of security assistants and uniformed police officers. And I have to ask, it's an editorial comment here, what kind of school are we running here where we're talking about not increasing reading scores, math scores, and attendance and graduation rates, but we're talking about increasing the number of security assistants and uniformed police officers. Quote, it should not be a surprise to anyone when problems erupt within a school site. When you have the number of young people together, she explained, you have to be strong and send a message of what the rules are. Well, I don't know what that means because, you know, by high school, you'd think that they would get the rules. Back to the article, Milwaukee police say one 17-year-old female student was arrested after it was discovered that she brought pepper spray to school. A 15-year-old male student was detained and charged with disorderly conduct after he threw scissors at a teacher in a classroom. The scissors missed and the teacher was not injured. In addition to the 15-year-old male student who was shot with a taser for fighting with a school safety assistant, a 15-year-old female student was detained for fighting with a Milwaukee police sergeant, and a 15-year-old male was charged with disorderly conduct for fighting with a school security assistant and refusing to leave the property. Milwaukee Public Schools sent a letter home to Vincent High School parents saying, we are writing to reaffirm with you that we remain committed to providing a calm, safe atmosphere for learning. Well, apparently they're not doing a very good job of it. The district also released actions it will take to get the school under control, including metal detector scans. As students enter the building, possible cancellation of after-school activities if students become out of order, and possible changes to the administrative and safety staffs, whatever that means. When asked whether staff changes could include removing the school's current principal, Alvin Baldwin spokeswoman Roseanne St. Albans said, you know, everything is possible. This is a quote. You know, everything is possible. We can change anything. I'm not going to put the heat of light on any one person. We have issues here that are student-based from what we can see in the last couple of days. Monday, Vincent High School became the scene of an unruly pandemonium after fighting broke out in numerous locations throughout the building. Police said they would stop one fight just as another would happen in another area of the building. The school district conceded that as many as 100 students were running through the hallways and refusing to go to class. You know, when I read this and I've followed this story, this is nothing new. Vincent had an incident at the end of last school year. Some similar violence. Several years ago, they had a shooting at a basketball game that resulted in a homicide. We've seen ugly stories coming out of Vincent High School. And again, this is a school system afflicted by this type of unruly behavior from our young people. And it's not just synonymous with Milwaukee students. I have another situation in Chicago where a 16-year-old teen was beaten to death on the way home from school. And this stemmed from a fight earlier at the high school. And then five teens in a Florida city have been charged with setting another teen on fire after they accused this kid of stealing a bicycle. And, you know, you look at this, we're talking about a generation of kids growing up without values. This is plain and simply bad parenting. This is neglect. It's a form of child neglect. The solutions are not easy. I understand this, but the reason I wanted to bring this up today, and we're not going to get to spend a lot of time on it, we can't avoid these issues just because they're tough, just because they're uncomfortable. When I get the opportunity to appear on this show, we will not avoid issues because we don't really want to talk about them, the behavior of our young people in a school system that, and I talked about it with Corey Nettles earlier, if you can't provide a safe environment, kids are not going to learn. Teachers cannot come to work every day fearing for their safety. Other students, the overwhelming majority who might be there for the right reasons, they can't come to school and be intimidated and worry about a fight breaking out. Someone bringing pepper spray to school because, you know, out of fear they might be attacked or get in the middle of this fight. I'll tell you what, these are red flags, folks. And until MPS, and this falls in the lap of Bill Andrikopoulos, you know, until they get this stuff literally under control. And just because we don't read about it every week doesn't mean it's not happening. It's an intimidating environment. I've been in some of these schools, and there is a lot of disorder, a lot of chaos. And then you wonder why we have the test scores, reading scores, you know, eighth grade reading scores, worst in the nation was a headline of the Journal Sentinel last year, and some of the other ugly headlines coming out of this. It's a behavior. And until parents, along with teachers, administrators, demand, until we as a society demand more from our young people. Again, they're growing up without values, you know, values like respect, values like courtesy, values like how to handle a dispute that should be taught at home well before they get to high school. This is something I would expect. I would expect kids and, you know, young kids, you watch young kids get together, 3, 4, 5 years old, they'll fight, they'll argue. They don't have social skills. They're still developing. That's age-appropriate behavior because, you know, you don't expect a five-year-old to grab a pair of scissors and do some deed like that. But when they get to high school and they don't have these skills, you know, we're talking about a generation of uncivilized, antisocial behavior that's being exhibited and coming out in forms that are not going to go away until these things are directly addressed. And I don't mean this passive approach that I'm hearing from Roseanne St. Aubin with some of this gobbledygook, and, you know, that she's issuing these releases. I mean, I don't know what it means with some of the things that she's saying. So if you're a student at Vincent, I don't know how you're doing it. For those that are learning and doing well, I don't know. You have my sympathy that you're stuck in that school system, but that's all part of the questions that have to be answered about MPS. It isn't just about the structure. It isn't just about who should control and make the decisions. Should it be an elected school board? Should it be the mayor? Like I said earlier, those are the structural questions. Those are the technical fixes. I'm talking about the adaptive fixes. How do we improve reading scores? How can a teacher teach in an environment where they don't feel safe? If we can't provide a safe passage, and I'm talking about not just in the school, that's why I say a safe passage to and from school, because a lot of this then spills out of the high school and it's carried on like in Chicago with a 16-year-old teen. And by all accounts, this was a good kid who got caught up in the melee and lost his life on the way. He was beaten to death, fatally beaten in an after-school mob melee. When we can't guarantee a safe passage to and from school and then while at school for students and teachers, I think it's terrible commentary about the state of not just MPS, but our young people and our society. And, you know, this is what we've raised as a community, as a society. It starts with the parents. It starts in the home. But when this goes on in society and we become tolerant of it, when we become just pay lip service, because that's all I'm hearing from MPS is lip service. You know, we have to do more. We have to crack down. Some of the terminology used here is what's used for prison disturbances. When you talk about lockdown, that's what they do in prisons. When a school uses a phrase, or we had to do a lockdown, it just, to me, shows the state of our schools. And I'm telling you, I don't know how we're going to turn this around, how we're going to get these kids ready to be productive people in society when they don't possess even the simplest social skills to make this happen. It is 5:50. 1290 WMCS, the talk of the town, Sheriff Clark in for Earl Ingram. It's been a pleasure, ladies and gentlemen. I'll tell you what, we got through this, and it was painless, a little shaky at first as I got my bearings underneath me. It's been a pleasure. It's been an opportunity that I'm really thankful for, and I look forward to the next time that I can come in and spend an afternoon with you. Up next, Blues After Dark with Debo. Phil Anderson is out today, but stay tuned for our next segment. Thank you and good night.
Views and opinions expressed on The Evening Rush do not necessarily reflect those of 1290 WMCS or our advertisers.